This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Great news about today's show. My guest is composer, pianist, bandleader, and singer John Batiste, and he's at his home piano, ready to play some music for us. It's been quite a year for him. He's the music director and bandleader of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, which had been produced at the Ed Sullivan Theater with an audience, but since the pandemic, Batiste and the members of his band, Stay Human, have been performing from their homes. He's gotten out into the streets to perform at protests after George Floyd was killed. He's also done pop-up performances, including at a mass vaccination site in New York. He just won a Golden Globe and a Critics' Choice Award for the score of the animated film Soul. He composed, arranged, and performed the jazz parts of the score. And now he has a new album called We Are that brings out his love of soul, R&B, pop, gospel, and marching bands, as well as jazz. And of course, you can hear the influence of New Orleans, where he's from, where his family is known for playing music. He started performing with his family's band when he was a child. Let's start with the title track of We Are. That's the title track of John Batiste's new album, We Are. John Batiste, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love this album. It is great to have you back on the show. What's the backstory of this song? How did you write it? It's the title track of your album. It's the name you've given protests that you've led.
Yep, We Are. It's the question and it's the answer all in one. And the backstory is really something that happened in a six-day recording session in my dressing room at the Ed Sullivan Theater. 6 days, 24/7, musicians. I was in and out of the dressing room at the time. I was also composing the score for Soul, doing the Late Show, and several other projects. But I had this bug to create. So I set up this studio in the dressing room, had food deliveries coming in at all hours. And after 6 days, we had the blueprint, really, the vision for what this album would be in about five or six songs. And We Are was one of the last songs that we created during that 6 days. And over the course of 8 or 9 months, ending during the first wave of the pandemic, I finished the album and cast the album, meaning I took all of these different demos and different sketches and found the right people to bring them to life. My high school marching band is on this song. It's a historically black high school, St. Augustine High School, and many leaders in the community, many leaders across the world in different sectors went to that school. And I went to that school and I was in the Marching 100. And my grandfather's on this track, he's preaching. My nephews are on this track. They're 5 and 11 years old at the time when we recorded this. And it represents the multi-generational realizations that we're undergoing right now, the multi-generational unlearning, the inherited struggles, the inherited triumphs. And the Gospel Soul Children Choir is on this song. They're an institution in New Orleans music and represent the deep faith and spiritual underpin of all of the music that's presented here. And there's so many others that have collaborated with me on this album.
I want to play another song from the new album. And this is like a very joyful song. It's called I Need You. And it's so well produced. I'd love it if you could play like the sketch of the song when the idea for the song was germinating and you were in the process of composing it. And when it was still a kind of naked song without all the production. If you could do that for us and then we can hear what it sounds like fully produced, that would be great. Would that be okay?
Yes, that's great. So I Need You really starts with the bass line. You hear this bass line all throughout American music. See, early rhythm and blues, black social music, rock and roll, all of it has this kind of, and that bass line is something that is really important in American music because it's the dance bass line. It has something in it that makes you want to get up and dance immediately, which is what we wanted this song to have, that spirit of dance and joy, as if you were rekindling that feeling that happened back when people played in the Chitlin Circuit, you know, Little Richard playing in the Chitlin Circuit, or the feeling of the Lindy Hop or the Jitterbug in Harlem in the 30s. I wanted to capture that and blend it with what you might hear on pop radio or in a hip hop song. And sonically, that's what we did. We took this. We took that bass line and blended it with 808 kick drums. And we put all types of different drum programming around that feeling of the acoustic bass played by the wonderful India Owens of Stay Human. And then once we had that laid out, the rest, it just was self-explanatory. What story do you want to tell? That's what I always ask myself. What is it that I want to say? What do I want people to take away from this? And when you hear the lyric, in this world with a lot of problems, all we need is a little loving. That's it. All we need.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. So let's hear the actual recording of it, fully produced from John Batiste's new album, We Are. I Need You from John Batiste's new album, We Are. I just love that track so much, and I love the video too because there's great dancing on it. You dance on it, and you look great when you're dancing, and then there's some great like dancers doing like Lindy Hop and Jitterbug, and it just explodes with joy in every way, musically and the dance. So, you know, your emphasis in your music is often on joy, and like that track, you wrote it before the pandemic or during the pandemic?
So that track was something that also occurred during the 6 days that I was in my dressing room at the Ed Sullivan Theater, which, important side note, is the dressing room of the great Carol Burnett. She told me that 2 years into me having that dressing room, I didn't realize it until I met her and we worked on this project together. And she said, you have my dressing room. And long story short, I started to record out of it and try to tap into all of the spirits that are present in that building. And this song was the last song of that initial 6 days in September 2019.
Over the summer, you played at some protests after George Floyd was killed. How did you figure out what mood you wanted to express musically? Because I think there's been something of a discussion about whether these protests should include joy, or whether they should just be, you know, express, you know, the anger at the injustices.
I want to reaffirm people's humanity when it's being under such duress and when it's under attack. Thinking about people who exist in the world at this time, you're constantly bombarded with so much via politics, via all of the mass media. Everything is kind of targeting people, pushing them to pick a side. And I wanted to articulate through the music and through my presence there that we're all in this together. We're all existing in this space, this city, and ultimately, this is our time, this is our world. We have to come together and understand that, or else everything is going to completely disintegrate.
You've performed the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice, and I would love it if you could play that for us now. It's such a stirring song. And it dates back to the early 1900s. It was written with a lyric by James Weldon Johnson and music by his brother, J. Rosamond Johnson. And this song has just lived on and become a really important anthem. Tell us what it means to you when you first heard it.
It's ubiquitous. It's one of those songs that, whether you're at a Black barbecue or if you're watching a sporting event, if, in particular, if you have gone to sporting events in the South, you know, like the Bayou Classic or HBCU events, you'll hear it. Or if you go to church, Black churches, you know, talk about my grandfather on the record. Well, he's an elder in the AME church, and you're going to hear that song. But I laugh because it just brings back so many memories of community and really what I strive to create a lot when I perform. It just is a sense of joy that comes from community. And that song is one of the pillars of the Black community.
Would you play and sing Lift Every Voice for us?
Absolutely.
This year has been quite a year for you, because in addition to the pandemic and the police killings, and having to work from home for late night, you've also, you know, just won two big awards for the score for Soul, the animated film Soul, which is a terrific film. And so I thought I'd switch over to talking a little bit about Soul. This is a different kind of musical writing for you, because you're underscoring an animated film. It's not just composing a song that's expressing your feelings. It has to underscore the storyline. It has to be music that's underneath the action that's happening. I was wondering if you could talk about a scene that you did the underscoring for, and you know, play us and describe the thinking behind what you came up with.
Absolutely. So, wow, there's so much in that film that I could talk about. It was incredible to score the looking at life moment where 22 is looking at life for the first time.
And 22 is a soul who hasn't inhabited a body yet. And she's voiced by Tina Fey, and she's very skeptical about going to Earth and being in a body and having to live life on Earth. Go ahead.
Absolutely. There's I wanted to take that pentatonic sound, that sound. Pentatonic is a five-note scale that feels very pure. It is, when you go through the cycle of fifths, pentatonic scale is naturally there. It's a basis for a lot of things in all different cultures. Eastern music use the pentatonic, the blues, they use the pentatonic. All of this African music that you hear, pentatonic. So I wanted to create this sense of universality at the same time as I created a sense of purity, childlike wonder. So I wanted to create this nursery rhyme-esque bass line. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6, 1, 2, 3. So that feeling of it bouncing around with this melody on the top. So that thing is going on with the saxophone, the bass line is happening, and then it feels as if she's walking through, or this soul is walking through life and seeing things for the first time, and is glazed over with wonder and awe. And it's a feeling of connecting for the first time to life, which, if you've seen the story, 22 didn't want to go to Earth for the longest time. And I just wanted to imagine what that would sound like for somebody who is in the sweet embrace of life for the first time ever. So then there's this moment, it gives me chills thinking about it. There's this moment where they turn the corner. This stuff is so deep to put into words because it's so much a part of our lives, all of us. All of us have had these feelings, this understanding of seeing something in life and just being blown away by the wonder of it all. So I wanted to find a way to put that into a harmonic progression that matches a moment on screen when they turn the corner and the sun is going down and they're in the West Village or something that looks like the West Village, and it just is this amazing sequence, this moment that feels so, so impactful to me, just because I remember those times when I was just new to New York City and I was in the Village and I was going to my first gig in the Village, and the sun was going down and just the wonder of feeling that. So I wanted to capture that with some harmonies. It's like, so those harmonies. Those harmonies point towards the celestial. Those moments in life that are both physical and metaphysical. Those moments in life where we feel the connection to the creator, the higher power, yet we're still on Earth. And that feeling of looking at life
is really what I think we got.
What did you have sound to learn from?
That sound. Oh, that makes me so emotional when you hear that. Then I took, you know, those kind of like Alice Coltrane sort of melodies. Woo, man. There's so much in this. So that, woo, that part gets more complex. It layers. It's like, wow, there's so much that life has to offer. It's melancholy a little bit, but it's also like, ah, wow, this is beautiful. I'll take the good with the bad. I want to be here. I want to be alive. I'm sorry.
That's the message of the movie.
It's great.
That is the message of the movie. The close credit music for Soul is the Curtis Mayfield song, It's All Right, which you sing on the close credits. It was such a surprise and so wonderful to hear you do that. You're singing in your falsetto for this, and it made me wonder, was like Curtis Mayfield a big influence on you? Did you listen to him a lot?
Yes, he writes contemporary black hymns. He writes hymns for humanity. His music is something that I really aspire to, both lyrically and also the way that he sings. He has that way of singing in the falsetto, but he's telling you a story. It's all right. It's all right. He's just talking, you know, it's like I'm just speaking. He can go in and out of speaking, like, it's all right. Have a good time, cause it's all right. Whoa, it's all right. It's like, it's something that feels like a relative is talking to you, and it makes you comfortable with some of the heavier themes of what he's written about. And that's really been something that impacted me a lot.
Was it your choice to use that? I mean, because it actually has the word soul on it. You've got soul, and everybody knows that it's all right. So it not only feels...
You've got soul, and everybody knows. Ha! Yeah! That it's all right. Oh, it's all right. Oh, my goodness. You heard that? I did that on purpose, but I didn't know if anybody heard that.
Would you do a little bit more of that for us, of the song?
Oh, yeah, yeah. See? See? This all right. Cause it's all right. It's all right, have a good time, cause it's all right, whoa, it's all right.
It's funny, that song seems to really fit into your aesthetic.
Yes, I love this part when he say, when you wake up early in the morning, feeling sad like so many of us do. Just the way that those chords, you hear that, those minors, and the way that the lyric, feeling sad like so many of us do, but then it's good, just hum a little soul, make life your goal, and surely something's gotta come to you. Say it's all right. Say it's all right. It's all right. Have a good time, cause it's all right. And then a part I also love is when he's like, you've got soul, and everybody knows that it's all right. Yeah.
That's really wonderful.
You know, it feels so good.
Thank you. So it feels very good for me to hear it. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Would you end with a hymn or, you know, spiritual gospel song for us? I know you sometimes do this kind of music at your pop-up performances and street performances, and it would just be a beautiful way to end.
Oh, yeah.
That was beautiful. John Batiste, you're just so wonderful. Thank you so much for your generosity in playing for us on today's show. And thank you for all of your music and for your work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Just so much that you do. It's just been a pleasure to have you on our show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a joy, and I'm looking forward to the next time.
Oh, I am. And I'm going to take you up on that. Thank you so much. John Batiste is the music director and band leader of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. His new album is called We Are. Our thanks to David Patterson, who did the audio engineering on John Batiste's end. Coming up, we'll hear from magician Derek Delgadio. His new memoir, A Moral Man, recalls a time when he turned his sleight-of-hand skills to cheating in high-stakes poker. Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. Here he is to introduce it.
Our next guest, Derek Delgadio, has a career that's, well, a little hard to describe. He's a writer, performer, artist, and though he doesn't exactly think of himself as a magician, he is skilled in the arts of illusion and has three times won Magician of the Year awards from the Academy of Magical Arts. He has a new memoir in which he describes a time in his life when he had another identity, a card cheat. He was the well-paid dealer in a private poker game where his job was to use his card handling skills to take most of the players' money. He describes techniques he used and what it felt like to deceive people at a table where the stakes could be deadly if a player caught on to his game. Derek Delgadio is perhaps best known for a live show he performed for 2.5 years in Los Angeles and New York, directed by Frank Oz, called In and of Itself. It's now a movie, also directed by Frank Oz, which is available on Hulu. His new memoir is A Moral Man, A True Story and Other Lies. He joins me from his home in New York City. Derek Delgadio, welcome to Fresh Air. So you, as a teenager, got to spending a lot of time in this magic shop owned by this man, Walter, and you learned from his books and his tapes, and you learned from professional magicians that he knew. And eventually you wanted to meet somebody who wasn't a magician, but somebody who made a living hustling with cards. How are these people and their world different from that of performing magicians?
The stakes for card sharks or card mechanics are very different than the stakes for a magician, in that they're working in the real world, not a theatrical world. You know, if a magician messes up, they just don't get applause. But if a card cheat messes up, who knows what can happen? Could just be that he's sent on his way. It could be much worse. And their intentions are different. You know, magicians broadcast their secrecy. Even when they're concealing something from you, they want you to know that they're concealing something from you. That's part of where they get recognition for their talents, is that they know more than you about a thing. And they want you to know that, because that's what this is about. It's about a demonstration of power, in a sense. And cheats are the opposite. They need to conceal everything, including especially the secret, and they can't broadcast their secrecy at all. They must contain all of it, and it must appear as if nothing is happening other than what should be happening. So you can see it in the hands of a magician. A magician adds an extra flourish, or there's an elegance to maybe the way he handles a deck of cards, and a fluidity, where a card cheat might be sloppy and might seem immature with the way that they hold cards, or rough, or, you know, like they might grab it like they'd grab an axe. There's nothing dainty or elegant about it. And so they just have different approaches. And I became obsessed with sleight of hand, and I gravitated towards what would be considered the more difficult sleights, because I think it was what got the attention of the people I admired. They liked seeing a young kid do things that they maybe had never seen anyone do. And so the harder the move, the more eager I was to learn it. And the hardest moves that I had come across were the moves from the gambling world. And these are things like bottom deals and false shuffles and run-up shuffles and tabled pharaohs and second deals, and just the moves that are almost mythical in terms of magicians sort of maybe can do them or have heard of them, but they have never really done them or seen them done the way they should be done. And so I wanted to learn those things.
The best of the best. Wow.
Those moves are considered the most difficult. I don't know if that's actually true. I mean, there's difficult moves in all branches of sleight of hand, but what makes them exceedingly difficult is how they have to simulate real life in such a way that it must look exactly like what it represents. So if we're talking about false deals, which is like what I did at the card table, it can't look like you maybe took a card off the top. It has to look like you took a card off the top every single time. As opposed to in magic, it's okay if maybe he did something. The maybe he did something is often the point of magic. Maybe he snuck the ball under the cup. I didn't see it, but I felt it. That feeling of maybe he did something is often encouraged in magic shows, where it's a game of cat and mouse and can you catch me or not. That doesn't exist in the gambling world. There's no performativity of the hands. There's no performativity of the mannerism. It all has to live as a simulation of real.
So you're a friend at the magic shop. Walt connects you with a guy named Ronnie, and you meet him at a pool hall in Denver. You have to take a bus. You're, what are you, 17 maybe at the time or something?
17, yeah.
And he wants to see you do something to prove that you're, you know, you got some game, and you do. And a friendship develops. You end up driving with him from Colorado to Knoxville. He doesn't fly, so he's going to go there. You want to just tell us a little about him and what you learn hanging with him?
Yeah, I mean, Ronnie is several people to me. He's a card mechanic, a grifter of sorts, and one of the last real card mechanics in the country, and people who actually do these moves, the sleight of hand, the bottom deals, and false shuffles, and table hops, and things like that. These are things that aren't usually done now, or haven't been done in years, because when most people think of card cheats, they're thinking of someone from, you know, 50, 100 years ago, the cowboy who saddles up to the table and deals off the bottom of the deck. That hasn't existed for quite some time, because why would you do that when you could develop some sort of advanced camera system with marked cards and electronics that allow you to just devastate a game with very little practice, relatively speaking. So those types of card sharps or sleight of hand experts didn't really exist when I was coming around in the late 90s. And so I had to figure out how to get to Denver, and and meet this guy.
There's a point where you're on this road trip and you're at a barbecue joint, and you kind of joke to Ronnie that maybe you might want to get into the business. And then he gives you a pretty stern message. What does he do?
Yeah, I brought up the topic of me playing in a game like the games that Ronnie had played in. And it was very clear from the beginning of our relationship that I was not going to use the things that I was doing or learning in card games. Ronnie would never have probably taught me anything or give me the time of day if he thought I was doing it to enter the world that he was living in. He just, you know, met a young kid who was interested in what he did in a technical sense, and I really did admire his virtuosity. And so it was kind of an unwritten agreement between us that he would teach me things as long as I was only going to use it for good. And then one day I kind of crossed that line and I asked him, well, what if I did do what you did? What if I did try to play in a game? What do you think about that? And his answer was showing me the scars on his back that he had never shown me before. He was playing in a game and was taken out back afterwards or confronted after the game and stabbed a few times with a pocket knife and left for dead. And I didn't know that part of him because he'd been concealing that part of his life and who he was from me. And so it was kind of a wake-up call.
You don't want this life, kid, in other words, was the message. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you sought other employment. You take us to a point where you're 25 years old and you're living with Vanessa, who's now your wife, right? Vanessa Lauren. And she's employed. You're kind of underemployed trying to find jobs and not quite sure what to do. And then you get a call from Ronnie, the old card player from way back. And he has a need and a proposition. What does he tell you?
Yeah, Ronnie had gotten in trouble with the law for violating a probation that he had been on for getting in trouble with the law earlier. And he needed some help. He had been dealing in a private poker game in Beverly Hills. And he asked if I would sub for him. I would go in as his substitution until he got out of jail. And he didn't want to call me. He didn't want to even ask me, but I was kind of the only person who geographically and perhaps physically could do what was required at this game.
Yeah, and had the skills. I mean, he knew you had the skills. You're reluctant. You say, I'm not so sure. He says, well, go talk to them. So while Ronnie's doing time for his probation, parole violation, you end up going there and to this mansion, and there's this poker game, and you end up agreeing to do it. You want to just describe the place, the setup, the players?
Yeah, it's a fancy house in the hills. It's where those tour buses in Hollywood drive around, and they point to celebrities' houses for the tourists to take pictures of. It was a house like that behind a big wall, and inside it was, you know, decorated not for living but for setting a tone, which is of money and of lifestyle, basically. It's like a Pinterest house. They had fake artwork on the walls and big leather couches for people to sit in, and it was built for comfort so that people would come and feel cozy and stay. When the games were going on, there was a chef in the kitchen who would make whatever players wanted to eat, and there were beautiful women who would serve the drinks, and they even had a masseuse from time to time to come rub the shoulders of people after sitting at the table for so long. So it was just a nice house with nice environment inside.
Right, and the players would come. They would learn by word of mouth. What was the minimum, you know, stake that a player had to put up to get in the game?
$10,000 to buy in.
Okay.
And but it was no limit, so they could lose as much as they'd like.
Right, right. So there's this whole operation, and Leo is the guy that runs it, and his son Max, and they're going to get all the money. And the fascinating thing is all these players, there are chefs and waiters and legitimate dealers who have no idea what the real business plan is, and even a legitimate guy who thinks he's the boss, they're all kind of part of a game that they don't really understand, right? Your job is to get in there as dealer on occasion and steer everything the right way.
Correct. I was hired as what's known as a bust-out dealer. Technically, bust-out dealer is a term used for blackjack, but it's the same thing in this context, where there was a poker game and there were other professional poker dealers who were hired to deal this game. And I was hired also, and I had to dress like them, wear the same, you know, black pants, white shirt, same uniform. But when I was there, I steered the game and controlled the narrative of it to help the people who hired me win.
So you go in, and the first night, you think you're just going to do some regular dealing for a while, but Leo, your boss, he wants you to get in there and start fixing this right away. What was it like?
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is these things happen in steps. You know, I only said yes to agree to meet with the people that employed Ronnie because he asked me to, and he's a friend, and I knew it was easier to say no to his employer than it was to him. So I said yes to Ronnie so I could say no to his boss. But then his boss told me that I didn't have to necessarily cheat on the first game. All I had to do was just come deal. So for me, the idea of just dealing in a poker game for a night didn't seem like that tough of a job and something I could write off as an experience. So I thought the first night was just me practicing and learning to become basically a professional dealer. And by the end of that night, he thought I was doing so well, he encouraged me to cheat. And so I found myself in a position of having to make a moral decision on a night where I thought I was just going to have to be a dealer in a poker game.
And what was that experience like?
Out of body? Perhaps. It was tough because it was all physical and mental, in the sense of I had trained a large portion of my life to physically do these things, and I had wondered if I had what it takes. Could I do these things? Because you mythologize them. These people who go in games and sit down and do these things, and you wonder, like, wow, if I watched The Sting like it was a documentary, you know, and think like, oh, could I sit at a table and do these things? Like if push came to shove. And so, you know, you wonder if you're capable of these things. And now I found myself literally, you know, sitting at the table at the moment of, are you capable of doing these things? And I found myself at a ledge, and I took the leap.
How did Vanessa, your girlfriend, feel about it?
She was conflicted because on the one hand, she knew I was doing this really to help a friend, or at least that's the narrative that I told myself at the beginning. But, you know, she wanted to support me in finding out who I was and what I'm to do here. But also there was concerns, you know, of coming home safely. And it was temporary. The only reason there was any sort of, I think, approval is not even the right word, but tolerance of it, is because it was a temporary thing. It was just do this a little to help a friend. But then as it went on, it became more of a concern of, is this what you do now?
Let's go around the table and look at some of these characters. I mean, there's Leo, the guy who's the boss running all this. And then there's his son, Max, who, and you got to let him win some because Leo can't win every hand. That would look fishy. Then a lot of them are guys that they refer to as donks. Who are the donks?
The donks are the suckers. Donks, which is short for donkey, which is, of course, jackass. The donks are the suckers who came to that house. And so that was everyone that they were trying to take money from.
Who thought they were at a regular game and weren't. And then there were guys that you refer to as Honest Johns. This is interesting. Maybe one per game, right?
Yeah, the Honest John was really fascinating. The Honest John was someone that the boss hired to sit and win so that I could deal to them, so that they could be the big winner. Because obviously if the same person won, like if Max or Leo won every night, like you said, that would look suspicious. So they always, not always, but they would rotate in what they'd call an Honest John, which was the guy determined to be the big winner that night. But they didn't know that they were part of a crooked game. These were poker players, some of them very prominent poker players, who just thought that they were sitting in to play a poker game. It's not uncommon for a good poker player to be backed by someone. And, say you get to play, here's $10,000, $50,000, go play in this poker game, you get to keep 20% of whatever you win.
This came to an end quite suddenly. I mean, your friend Ronnie had gotten out of jail, was going to come back, but they wanted you to both stay as dealers. And you decided in a flash to get out. Why?
I had a moment of clarity. It was never a life that I had thought that I would end up in. Realistically, it was always like I had romanticized that idea of that life in my head, as movies would allow us to do. But I had a moment of real life when a man who I had met at the table before, a player, had just lost all his money, and he reached into his pocket and pulled out his last $5 bill and gave it to me as a tip, which was very common for people to tip me, but usually they tip me with poker chips. And it was something about that moment where I saw the humanity of what was happening, or the lack of humanity of what was happening inside of that house, that was sort of was a moment of awakening, and that there are real people at the other end of these acts, and they're being deceived in such an explicit way that's even beyond deception. These people aren't, they were living fictions as though they were truths. And it was a big realization that I was a part of this deception in a way that was much bigger than I had really thought about. It was such a striking moment that I decided to just never go back.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Derek Del Gaudio's new memoir is called A Moral Man, A True Story and Other Lies. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. You can see the film adaptation of his stage show called In and of Itself on Hulu.